Welcome to the Business of Government Hour, a conversation about management with a government executive who is changing the way government does business. The Business of Government Hour is produced by the IBM Center for the Business of Government, which was created in 1998 to encourage discussion and research into new approaches to improving government effectiveness. You can find out more about the center by visiting us on the web at businessofgovernment.org. And now, the Business of Government Hour.
Welcome to a special edition of the Business of Government Hour, a conversation with authors exploring national security, power, and intelligence in the 21st century. I'm Michael Keegan, your host and managing editor of the Business of Government magazine. A decade into the 21st century, and the U.S. has encountered many unforeseen challenges and seemingly unimaginable opportunities. In the midst of these shifting dimensions, many are questioning the proper use of power, leadership, and security among the relations of nations to meet the demands of an ever-complex world. What is smart power? How do the challenges of the 21st century demand a reshaping and a redefining of leadership? How best can national security leaders transform the intelligence enterprise to meet the security needs of today? We will explore these questions and so much more with our very special guest, Professor Joseph Nye, University Distinguished Service Professor at Harvard University and author of The Future of Power. Professor Nye, welcome to the show.
Nice to be with you.
Also joining our conversation from IBM is Frank Strickland. Frank, welcome.
Thank you.
Professor Nye, your recent book, The Future of Power, represents a culmination of your exploration of the sources and trajectory of American power. You counsel that we need to understand power and how it changes in the 21st century. First, what is power in global affairs? And would you outline the three faces or aspects of relational power?
Well, power is simply the ability to affect others to get the things you want. And there are three ways to do that. You can threaten people with coercion, sticks. You can pay them, carrots. Or you can attract them and persuade them to want what you want. And that third way I call soft power. In practice, you need to use all three: economic, military, and persuasive power, or smart, to create smart power, which is the combination of hard and soft power. We sometimes talk about power as though it's just twisting arms, but that's not adequate. In fact, if you can set the agenda for others, and if you can set or help to establish their preferences so that they want what you want, then you can get a lot done without twisting arms.
Well, as a follow-up, why is it critical not to collapse all three faces of power into the first face, which is hard power? And why is it more effective to think of the three faces of power in reverse?
Well, the danger is that if you say, you know, it's all the same thing, getting people to do what you want, then you forget that if you can use these other aspects of power, you may be able to save a fair amount on carrots and sticks. And in that sense, I think the people who say, well, it's all, if I establish your preferences, I'm still making you want what I want. Well, not necessarily. I mean, if I can, before I have to twist your arm, if I can get you to want the kinds of things I want, then I don't have to twist your arm. And so the rather simplistic view of power, which goes back to, I don't know, the 19th century, that the mark of a great power is the ability to prevail in war, probably not adequate for an information age where it's not just whose army wins, but also whose story wins, whose narrative of soft power wins. So if we can get our narrative across, it may mean we don't have to use as much hard power.
Professor Nye, you point out that there are two great power shifts occurring in this century that distinguishes it from previous periods in world politics. Would you outline these power shifts, some of the key reasons and causes for the shifts, and possible consequences of those shifts?
Yes, one of the big shifts is the power transition, the movement of power from one set of states to another set of states. And that you might call the movement from west to east. In 1800, more than half of the world's population and more than half the world's product was in Asia. By 1900, that was down to just 20% of the world's product as a result of the Industrial Revolution in Europe and North America. Sometime during this century, we're going to see a return to what you might call normal proportions. Asia will be more than half the world's population and more than half the world's product. And we're going to have to figure out how we adjust to that. That's going to be a big issue. Sometimes people call this the rise of China, predict that the rise of China will lead to conflict. It's really the rise of Asia overall, and there are a variety of ways in which we can manage the rise of China within that broader context. But the other great shift is power diffusion, which is the movement of power away from all states, east or west, to non-state or non-governmental actors. And that's basically a function of the extraordinary information revolution that we're living through right now. In the last quarter of the 20th century, the price of computing power dropped 1,000-fold. If the price of automobiles had dropped as rapidly, you could buy a car today for $5. When anything goes down in price that dramatically, people are no longer priced out of the market. The barriers to entry go down. So it's not as though governments are not still important. They obviously are. But it just means the stage on which governments act is a lot more crowded than it ever used to be.
So when you're describing the distribution of power in the world, you use the metaphor of a complex three-dimensional chess game. Would you elaborate on the characteristics and particulars of each level of the chessboard, and why did you choose that to capture this and convey this information?
Well, no metaphor is perfect, but the three-dimensional chess metaphor reminds people that power always depends on the context and that the distribution of power is very different in each context. So power in the military area may be very different from power in the economic or in the transnational area. Let me tell you what I mean. Think of this three-dimensional chessboard and the top board of military relations among states. In that board, the Americans are the only global superpower. We're about half of the world's military expenditure. Nobody can balance that power. And we're likely to remain that way for, I would say, another decade or two. So on the top board, people often say the distribution of power in the world is unipolar. Go to the middle board of economic relations among states, and it's quite clear that the world is multipolar. Economics is the area where Europe can act as one entity when it wishes to, and when it does, its economy is larger than that of the United States. In addition, you have China, Japan, and others who we have to bargain with to get what we want. That's multipolar. But you go to the bottom board of transnational relations, things that cross borders outside the control of governments. That could be anything from hot money flows to criminal gangs to cyber terrorism to impersonal processes like climate change or pandemics. In that area, power is chaotically distributed. Nobody's in charge. This is the area where diffusion of power is increasing the number of challenges to governments, but in which it makes no sense at all to talk about unipolarity or multipolarity. And the only way you can get the outcomes you want on this bottom board is by cooperation, by attracting others, by using your soft power to get others to work with you in networks and institutions to deal with these types of issues.
Power is conveyed through resources, but power is not synonymous with resources. Would you tell us more about power conversion strategy and some of the key issues converting power resources into strategies that produce outcomes and perhaps an example?
Yeah, sometimes people look at the resources that may or may not produce power and just say that's power. So you look at one country and it has 10,000 main battle tanks. And another country has 1,000 main battle tanks, and you say country A is 10 times stronger than country B or 10 times more powerful. But that may be true if the battle is in a desert. It may not be true if the battle's in a swamp. So as we, the United States, found out in Vietnam. So it's very important to talk about the context in which certain resources may or may not produce power. And that means that a smart power conversion strategy is one which is able to adjust the various resources and use them in different mixes according to different contexts. For example, if you ask how will we deal with a threat of Al-Qaeda terrorism, one argument is, well, we just bomb them. But if you bomb them and in the process you create more civilian casualties than intended, so that increases Al-Qaeda's recruiting, you may actually do something that's counterproductive rather than useful for your objectives. Donald Rumsfeld once said, the metric for judging how you're doing in a war on terrorism is whether the number that you're killing or deterring is greater than the number they're recruiting. And in an effective strategy, you have to have a soft power component. You have to be able to gain the minds of the mainstream so that they are not recruited by Al-Qaeda. It's interesting if you look at the counterinsurgency strategy of the military, which is developed by General Petraeus. He makes it very clear that the objective is not how many people you can kill, it's how many minds you can win.
You note that it's not enough to think in terms of power over others. Would you elaborate on this perspective a bit more and what it means in practice?
Yep. Power can be zero-sum, where you need to have power over others, but it can also be positive-sum, where you get what you want by acting with others. So we often think too much of power over and not enough about power with. Let me give you an example. We're concerned about climate change. It can have damaging effects on the United States. China develops two new coal-fired plants every week, which is putting CO2 in the atmosphere, which is damaging to us. In fact, China is today the superpower of CO2. They've passed the U.S. in this. Now, the problem is, how do you deal with it? In one sense, in the top chessboard I mentioned earlier, you say, well, we could bomb those Chinese coal plants. Well, probably not. Lots of other costs. Another would be to, on the second board, to put up embargoes or boycotts or tariffs against Chinese goods if they continue to burn coal. And that would disrupt the international trading system and do us a fair amount of harm. But if you think about helping the Chinese to reduce the carbon intensity of their growth, that empowers China, but it also is good for us. And so that's an example of which, if you think of power with another country, it may be a better means of getting the outcomes we want than just power over another country, which may turn to be counterproductive.
So, Professor Nye, your career, in my mind, exemplifies the proper intersection of thinker and practitioner. To that end, would you tell us more about your career path and how did you get started and what brought you to writing your latest book, The Future of Power?
Well, I've always been interested in the intersection of politics and economics over history. I had actually studied a program at Oxford called Philosophy, Politics, and Economics, and then went to Harvard and got interested first in development economics and politics in Africa and did my initial field work on the East African common market, which seems a long way from what I'm doing now. But I followed an intellectual thread through this of this interrelationship between politics and economics and how they relate to each other. And that brings one to think about power. I mean, what does power mean? Who has the capacity to do what? To affect others, to get what they want. On the most recent aspect of what I've been working on, I wrote a book in 1989 called Bound to Lead, which was an examination of where the United States stood in the world. At that time, the conventional wisdom was the United States was in decline. As I tried to understand this, I first sort of looked carefully at American military power. Didn't seem that was in decline. I looked at American economic power, and while there are problems, I also didn't think that was in decline. But then I said, you know, even then, it hasn't summarized all the ways in which the Americans are able to affect others to get what we want. And that led me to this concept of soft power, our ability to set the agenda and to attract and persuade others, which struck me as equally important but largely neglected. And so for the last 20 years ago or so, since I published that book in 1990 and introduced the term soft power, I've been trying to think of how this plays out. And it's interesting that after the economic crisis of 2008, belief in American decline was revived. Ironically, after the Berlin Wall went down, Americans made the opposite mistake of thinking we were omnipotent and could do anything. Now, after the economic crisis, we again think we're in decline. I never believed either of those, that we were omnipotent or in decline. So I'm trying to figure out in this new book, where are we? How do we rate in terms of other countries, in terms of non-state actors, and how do we develop smart policies to deal with these changes?
What is smart power? We will ask Professor Joseph Nye, author of The Future of Power, when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour.